Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine, full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to tackle a subject that we haven't yet tackled on the Intelligent Medicine Podcasts. It's an important subject. It causes a lot of distress to a lot of people. The subject is hair, and specifically hair loss. We're going to talk to one of America's foremost experts on hair loss. Actually, for those of you with a good memory, he was a frequent contributor in our previous incarnation, the program Health Talk, heard on WOR. And I think it's been about 15 years since we've talked to him. So lots of developments on the hair technology front, and we want to be brought up to date. Our guest is Spencer Cobran. Spencer is, shall we say, a barefoot doctor, citizen activist, investigative journalist, who has delved into the issue of hair loss. He has his own podcast, which is entitled The Bald Truth, and you can check it out at thebaldtruth.com. Isn't that correct, Spencer?
That's right, Doc. How are you?
Great, great. And so you being a professional radio broadcaster, it's always fun to interview a fellow broadcaster because you can't go wrong because, we know you're glib.
Absolutely, and I have a lot of fond memories from being on your show in the past, and I miss WOR New York as well.
Indeed. Well, okay, so I will share your expertise with a different audience, a wider audience, via our podcasts internationally. So tell us a little bit about how your personal background, how you got into this, because you have a personal story that is really at the root of your efforts to find out the bald truth. So what's
well,
that?
Well, you know, to try to make a long story short, when I was about 21 years old, I realized that I was starting to lose my hair. And, you know, it kind of came as a shock to me because I didn't really see it in my family. Now, after I did some investigating, I realized, well, you know, I guess my dad is kind of balding. I never, you know, he had a hairline, but he always combed his hair back, so I never really looked for his bald spot. And then I found out that other family members along, you know, my dad's side were dealing with hair loss. And I thought to myself, oh, man, I guess this is really happening. So I decided to do some research. Now, mind you, this is like 1988. You know, this is like in the dark ages of the hair loss industry. And back then, and you know, a lot of things hadn't changed, but there really wasn't much information out there. And everything that you read, every time you tried to get information, you know, the internet was really basically non-existent or in its infancy. It was self-promoting stuff. There wasn't really a lot of great information out there. So I found myself, you know, going to the, you know, back of the sports pages and the yellow pages and getting my information that way and kind of like doing my own legwork in New York. And what I found out is because, you know, I was kind of like in the early stages of hair loss, you know, the hair loss wasn't that noticeable yet. I just saw that things were changing. But I noticed that everyone wanted to try to sell me something, whether it was a hair piece, you know, at you know, one of these large chain hair clinics or well-known doctors in New York wanted to perform a surgical hair restoration or hair transplantation at the time, and there wasn't really any place to put the hair. And I was thinking to myself, and I'm glad that I had the wherewithal to step back and say, hey, you know, there's something odd here. I don't know why these guys aren't trying to, you know, do something to kind of help me maybe maintain my hair. So I went to a couple of other places, and they were trying to sell me all kinds of lotions and potions, and I bought a lot of stuff that ended up not working. So after I read an article in the New York Times, I think it was in 1992, about a prostate drug that was, one of the side effects was guys who were using the drug, and these were older men, seemed to be growing some of their lost hair back.
This turned out to be Proscar, or finasteride,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I spoke to a local or family physician of mine, of our families, and I asked if he'd be willing to prescribe the drug, even though it would be prescribed off-label. And basically, they were, you know, Merck found that, you know, there was growing hair for guys with hair loss, and I was willing to take the risk. So the doctor looked it up in the PDR.
So you were a Proscar pioneer, because now it's common knowledge that these types of medications, now Avodart has superseded Proscar, but you were like, you were ahead of the curve.
Absolutely. You know, I was probably one of the first, if not the first, guinea pig. At least, you know, I mean, there were guys, obviously, that... you know, Merck had started trials, but I was one of the guys who decided to do it on their own. And the doctor was kind enough and thought that it was safe enough to give it a shot. Make a long story short, my hair loss slowed down significantly, actually stopped and reversed, and I grew back a significant amount of hair. Now, again, I wasn't visibly balding to most people. They would say I still had pretty good hair, but the crown was thinning, the hairline was receding, and I was able to kind of nip it in the bud. So after all of my research and all of my experience, I'm like, you know what? Someone's got to write about this industry, because it's really, in my view, at least back in the day, it was just a big con. Mm-hmm. And there were so many lotions and potions and all these, you know, bad transplants being performed. And after I did enough research, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to put a book together.
So it was missing consumer advocacy, essentially, as a free fire zone, a lot of conflicting claims, in essence, an unsolved problem with a lot of people providing solutions, some partially efficacious, but mostly bogus, right?
Well, that's right. And back in the day, it was really almost 100% bogus. You know, minoxidil still was, I guess in the 90s, it was cleared for FDA approved, I think, in 88 or 89. So that was really the only thing that we had. Everything else was completely bogus. So it was truly the Wild West. So I wrote my book. I shopped it around. I was lucky enough to sell it to Simon & Schuster, Pocket Books, which was a division of Simon & Schuster. And I guess the rest is history. That's how I got into it. And then I was lucky enough to be asked to do some media appearances and be on the radio. And after I was on the radio one time in New York, I was, kind of sparked an idea for me to start my own radio show. And that's how it all began.
Well, excellent. So why is this such a problem? You know, for some people, personally, I got to say I lack empathy on this because I got a full head of hair.
You do. Yeah. It's majestic, by the way.
Thank you. It's all those vitamins, I think. You should reconsider the vitamins. We'll talk about that later. But you actually go into depth about why this is such a distressing problem for men and for women. Well, yeah. What's going on? What is it about hair that makes it such a devastating problem? I mean, we're not talking terminal cancer here. We're not talking about, advanced, Alzheimer's disease. This is a malady, but why all the attention lavished on hair?
Well, the truth is, unless you are a hair loss sufferer, it's very difficult, like you just stated, to really understand how it affects people's self-esteem, how it affects, you know, the way we perceive ourselves, and honestly, how it affects the way people perceive hair loss sufferers. You know, it's kind of like, you know, being able to communicate your entire life a certain way, and then all of a sudden you lose half of your vocabulary. Your communication just completely changes. And the way we are perceived by the world is, frankly, you know, looks matter. And while, yes, you know, hair loss is a very common problem, especially amongst men, and it's actually very common amongst women, usually if it happens at an early stage in life, it can really erode a young guy's self-esteem along as his hairline erodes. And we notice things, you know, little subtle things like, you know, maybe you're not getting the same attention from the opposite sex, or maybe when you're looking in the mirror, you're a little less comfortable with yourself. And all of that really plays a lot to what we feel about ourselves and our lives and just our daily routine. So it's pretty devastating. It really is.
Well, you even stated in one of your blogs that, you know, there's a lot, everything is PC these days, you know, where we don't talk about the disabled, the handicapped. We talk, you know, we use like PC terminology. We don't talk about midgets or dwarfs. We
right.
talk about, you know, a vertically challenged individuals.
Yeah, little people, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit, whatever. But when it comes to hair loss, the people with hair loss, they're the butt of jokes. They're discrimination. It's open season, right?
Well, it's still like the last bastion of political incorrectness. And it's odd, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because we can't, you know, openly speak about, you know, someone, you know, a woman's, you know, acne or the size of her behind, or, you know, at least, you know, in a social setting, face to face. But for some reason, you know, as guys, we're supposed to just kind of man up and feel, okay, you know what, we could be the brunt of jokes because you're losing our hair. And what people don't understand is we, for the most part, have no control over it. It's like it's genetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a horrible feeling. And, you know, a lot of guys who call the program, they talk about how they relate in life and how hair loss has affected their lives and how people relate to them and how they still have to deal with being the brunt of jokes, even if it's a family member. I mean, I don't think a lot of people really mean to hurt the person they're making fun of. They kind of think that it's socially acceptable to goof on balding guys. And it's kind of it's difficult for most of us and for most guys who are dealing with it, but it's just a part of life. I wish it would be different, but I don't think it's going to change anytime soon.
Okay, so let's get to down to the nuts and bolts of this. You say that to a large extent, this is genetic. How genetic is it? Because some people, you know, they'll say, well, gee, maybe it's my lousy diet. Maybe I'm not getting the right vitamins, or perhaps it's stress. You know, I look at myself in the mirror and I just feel the stress coming on. And maybe the stress of my losing hair is making me lose more hair. Women actually share this with me.
Well, I will say that I believe, and most experts in the field believe, that common everyday stress has really little to do with hair loss. Now, you know, major stressors like, you know, having major surgery, being under mm-hmm. anesthesia for, you know, eight to 10 hours, or maybe the loss of a spouse or a child, or, you know, something to that extent.
Like a post-traumatic stress disorder or something, you know, wartime experience, starvation, and so on and so on.
Right. It may cause something known as telogen effluvium, which is basically all of your hair goes into it synchronizes into a telogen phase or a resting and loss phase, as opposed to, you know, having kind of like a sporadic anagen telogen phase. And that does happen. But the reason it's named androgenetic alopecia is because scientists found that what's really involved in the process is a combination of androgens and genetics. And if the person is genetically predisposed to being sensitive to the androgens that cause miniaturization of the hair follicles, or basically, a male-female pattern baldness, they are going to experience that. And the reason they kind of know it for sure now is because they do have medications that can reverse that process. And I think it's great if people are willing to change their diets and really want to make some significant lifestyle changes, because it's going to benefit them anyway, and it may benefit their hair to some degree. But the bottom line is diet and exercise and nutrition probably won't stop the progression of male or female pattern hair loss.
So you don't believe in the miracle grow theory of hair restoration, you know, just like the plant thing, you know, you put it in the flower pot and the plants just look beautiful. You don't believe that simply by taking some souped up vitamin formula, some protein, some collagen, some essential fatty acids and antioxidants and things like that's not going to make your hair sprout.
Yeah, you know, if that were the case, I would certainly not be here speaking to you and doing this podcast with you, because
then I would be doing the podcast, you know, solo, because from my multi-zillion dollar mansion here in Manhattan.
And that's the truth, you know. And the thing is, you know, most people will, you know, they want to go that route. They want to believe, you know. When you look up hair loss treatments on the internet, one of the first organic sites that you find would be the American Hair Loss Association, which is my organization. A lot of people will move past the organization and go to maybe one of the ads on the side, or maybe they'll go to somebody's website where they're selling an ebook, and they claim to have discovered the cure for hair loss in their mother's basement, and they're selling this book for $49.95.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of like circle back to the American Hair Loss Association and to the Ball of Truth to get the real information. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, people, you know, we're out there telling the truth. Not everyone's going to be helped. There are great treatments out there that work. But for the most part, there are two FDA-approved treatments that we know work for sure. There's one FDA-approved treatment that's prescribed off-label, which you mentioned, which is Avodart.
Mm-hmm.
There are some newer treatments that are being tested that seem to have some, you know, they have some legs and they seem to be working. But for the most part, that's it. It's a $3.5 billion a year industry. And 99% of the products and services being sold in the industry, don't work. I think it's even worse in the weight loss industry.
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, these are the these insoluble problems are just rife for scams. But so essentially, what you're telling me, we haven't spoken in 15 years. The science has not advanced that much. Although this is truly the holy grail of certainly the cosmetic surgery industry, the aesthetic industry is something that in a surefire way can promote hair regrowth, and yet they haven't nailed it yet.
Well, but, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, the science has advanced in certain areas of the industry. If you want to talk about surgical hair restoration for a minute, the science has definitely evolved significantly. You know, back when we spoke, the last time we spoke, the state-of-the-art procedure was something called follicular unit transplantation.
AKA hair plugs.
Not really plugs. I mean, plugs were the stage before follicular unit transplantation.
Okay.
And basically, follicular unit transplantation is where a physician would remove a strip of scalp, hair-bearing scalp, which is DHT-resistant, which will basically grow for life from the donor wreath of the balding person's head, suture that area together, and then give that scalp with hair, tissue and hair follicles to a group of technicians who dissect that tissue into what's known as follicular units. Now, hair grows in naturally.
So, excuse me, can I just to get you to reiterate that? You take it from a part of the scalp where the hair isn't falling out, where there is, you say, DHT resistant. In other words, there are certain different parts of the scalp, like, shall we say, the crown, the top of the head, but also the sides where the hair recedes. But there are places where the hair seems to be fairly robust even until old age. So you're saying they harvest it from there,
right?
And that's the source of the material that they use to distribute to the non-hairy places later.
Right, and I'll explain in brief. You know, the reason hair transplantation works is because of a theory called donor dominance. And if you notice in most balding men, that they do retain a significant amount of hair in what's called the donor wreath, which is the side and the lower back of the scalp, the occipital region.
Right.
That hair will grow in most men for life. You know, you may suffer from some age alopecia after 75 or 80 where that hair thins out a little bit. But in most men who aren't really like, you know, the high end of significant balders, they will retain that hair.
Right. You look like a tonsured monk, eventually, right?
Right?
That bald spot in the middle, but to the hair around the side.
That's exactly right. But that hair is usable hair. And if it's moved correctly and if it's moved in an aesthetic fashion, it could really make a significant difference. Now, and that hair, once it's put even in the balding areas, because it's resistant to the hormone that miniaturizes hair or the byproduct of testosterone, which is dehydrotestosterone, which is what actually shrinks the hair follicle, it's totally resistant, so it could be moved into the balding areas and will grow for life. So that's why hair transplantation works. You mentioned plugs. You know, hair transplantation really got a bad name because there was so much bad work being done, especially in the late 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all the way up to the early 90s, and into the late 90s, actually. But follicular unit transplantation was a procedure that recognized that hairs grow in naturally occurring bundles of 1, 2, 3, 4, and sometimes 5 hairs in a grouping. If those bundles are dissected as they are in nature, and and cut up into naturally occurring grafts and then replaced into the scalp, it can give you an incredibly natural appearance. Now, even when you and I spoke years ago, most doctors weren't performing it. I think there were about 25 doctors at the time who were doing it that way. So that's even why you said, you kind of mentioned plugs, because that's how society looks at hair transplantation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you don't see
it's very, very, very obtrusive, very, very obvious. But you're seeing less and less of that.
Right, right. And you're not going to see much of it. Maybe the old time transplant. Some guys are still doing not great work, but for the most part, that's a thing of the past. Now there's a procedure called follicular unit extraction, where they're able to extract using a very small instrument the entire follicular unit from the donor region without using a scalpel. So they're able to do this thousands of times from the back of the scalp using either a handheld instrument, a motorized device, and now there's a great robotic device called the Artist Hair Transplant System, which we can talk about. And they're able to move the same type of grafts, naturally occurring units, without causing a linear scar and without having to potentially cause some of the potential damage that can go along with any type of cosmetic procedure, like nerve damage and mm-hmm. you know, shock loss and things like that.
Incidentally, just to, if you don't mind my interrupting you, one of my just most unfortunate patients was a guy who did go in for some sort of hair transplant procedure. And so I'm not an expert on the different types.
Right.
I just know that he had the procedure. And he developed a chronic debilitating nerve pain syndrome in the back of his head, where I guess they had harvested some of the hair.
Sure.
And it was... It totally knocked this guy out. I mean, he was on such heavy-duty pain meds, there's nothing they could do to reverse it. Is this common, or was this an egregious mistake?
It's an experience like that. He probably went to a physician who he may have believed was really experienced, but it doesn't sound like, you know, the doctor's really experienced when he excised the tissue, because the truth is, it's a pretty shallow excision.
Okay.
So you really shouldn't be damaging those type of nerves. Now, there, you know, anytime you make a cut, you're going to separate, you know, the nerve endings in the scalp. So it will take time for sensation to come back. In some cases, it doesn't fully come back. There may be some numbness. But a case like that's extreme.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, you know, he went to a guy that probably wasn't that experienced.
Okay. So how common is that? I mean, these days, how do you know that you're going to the right person?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I founded the American Hair Loss Association many years ago. So we, you know, provide information to consumers. It's free of charge. They can go to the American Hair Loss website, which is AmericanHairLoss.org, and they can check out doctors who are recommended by the organization. And we recommend doctors who are in the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons. These guys are all real experts in their field. They all have a tremendous amount of experience. We also like to check out their staff, because what a lot of people don't understand is that hair transplantation is a team effort.
Uh-huh.
It's not just, you know, in order to move thousands of grafts in one sitting, in one session, it takes a team. One physician can't do the entire procedure. So sometimes, depending on how many grafts you have moved, you may have a team of 7, 8, maybe 9 people. You
mm-hmm.
know, so that's a physician and their technicians. You want to make sure your technician wasn't sitting up front yesterday answering phones and performing surgery on you.
Right, after a weekend seminar or something like that.
Exactly. So we do, you know, tell people that's a safe place to start, but the bottom line is they have to do their due diligence. Once they go to the list and once they find the doctors in the IHRS, then they have to speak with patients, speak to the doctor, not just check out before and after pictures and videos, but really try to meet these people in person. Because each person has different hair characteristics. You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all procedure. So you want to try to meet somebody who is kind of in your, you know, in your shoes, who may have the same pattern of hair loss, the same type of hair characteristics, the same skin color. And most of these doctors, well, actually all of the doctors in the IHRS, will be able to provide people with patients to speak with
mm-hmm.
and even patients to meet with. And I think that's really important.
Well, that's a good way to go. Now, what's the price of a procedure like that, typically?
Well, it depends. You know, I mean, it was really commoditized in the 80s by some of the large chain clinics. So these procedures are all done by the graft now, charged by the graft. So I'd say the average charge for a follicular unit transplantation, the strip method, is about $5 per graft across the country. That's average. So for 2,000 grafts, you're talking $10,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's pretty
penny. Follicular unit extraction, which is the newer technique, which is the less invasive technique, and really it's a technique that more younger patients are opting for because they're able to wear their hair much shorter. They don't have to worry about a linear scar. That can be anywhere from $7 to even $10 or $11 a graft.
So we could be talking 20 grand.
It's not an expensive procedure.
Possibly.
Yeah, and that's for one session. You know, now one standalone, you know, 2,500 graft session could really, you know, make a significant difference in someone's appearance.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say on average, guy needs to have at least two procedures. So, I mean, you know, these doctors they'll work with people and there's financing and stuff like that. But it's a commitment. It's not like your average cosmetic surgery. You go in, you say you get a chin implant and a couple of months of swelling is completely gone. You kind of see what you have in a couple of days anyway. You know, it takes a year for the hair to fully grow out.
And this is living tissue. It's not just, you know, reshaping.
That's exactly right. So you don't really know what you got, you know, until, you know, maybe six months to a year mm-hmm. down the road. I mean, it takes about a year till it's fully grown out. So a lot of guys who get it kind of have buyer's remorse. they're going through the ugly duckling phase, you know, they're waiting for the hair to grow, they have scabbing, all this stuff, and they go through this emotional roller coaster. The thing I like about the newer technique, the thing I like about follicular unit extraction is that it is relatively, compared to the strip procedure, minimally invasive. Once a guy has it done, he's not kind of stuck for life having more procedures because he's not going to have that linear scar. I'm still a proponent of the, you know, follicular unit transplantation for the right candidate, especially for older patients. But for younger patients, I really think, you know, you want to give them choices. And if you can provide them with a technique, even if it's more expensive, that is going to minimize the chance of complications, that is going to be just as aesthetically effective as far as having more hair in the front and in the crown as follicular unit transplantation, and give them more options as far as being able to cut their hair short without that concern about possibly seeing a scar in the back of their head, I think that's the way to go. And I usually tell guys, you know what, if it's a matter of price, don't get a scar on the back of your head just because you want to save some money.
Right. What about medical tourism, you know, because that's a big phenomenon. You can get a lot of operations that are done in the United States for a quarter of the price. You go to India, you go to Latin America, other countries, you know, are there reliable places across the world to get similar things done?
There actually are. Now, I'm not a huge fan of medical tourism for the most part, and a lot of the stuff that you see out there, especially in cosmetic surgery, is not great. And in hair transplantation, you know, mainstream cosmetic surgery is not great, but hair transplantation is even worse. We do have members who have kind of made the grade. It's a handful of guys, a couple of guys in Turkey and a couple of guys in India, and that's it, who we recommend, who are doing great work. So if you're willing to take the time to travel, and if you're willing to, you know, go basically to in some cases, it seems like a different universe, to have surgery, these are good guys to get it, to have it done by, and it's going to cost you less money. My concern is this, you know, I prefer to be as close to home as possible for any type of, you know, anything, you know. And if you have, God forbid you have complications, I always think it's best to be as close to your physician as possible. But if they go to an IHS member, you know, another IHS member close to their, you know, to their home would probably help out. So I know a lot of young guys who end up doing that. So, yeah, I mean, it can definitely work. But, you know, I mean, you're a physician yourself. Wouldn't you rather have a rapport with your patients?
No question. Yeah. So, all right, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. We've got lots more to talk about on the hair front, including some of the biggest scams in the hair field. We're talking to one of America's experts on hair loss and hair restoration. He's Spencer Cobran. He himself is the host of a podcast entitled The Bald Truth. He's also written a book called The Bald Truth. He's got a website at thebaldtruth.com. And when we return, more on the subject of avoiding and reversing hair loss. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.